We are very lucky to have a diverse. What would be the way to say? I guess a diversity of wildlife would be the way to say it here in Wisconsin. And no matter what time of year, there's lots to look at and look for and enjoy. Some are definitely no exception. Hi, Larry Mueller here. David Drake, wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology. One of our guests today to talk about the Wisconsin wildlife, Dave. David, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me back, Larry.
Appreciate it, really. And Jamie Knack, great to have you back as well. Jamie's a wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. And it's always a pleasure to see you in this studio.
Thanks, Larry, and I'm glad it's air-conditioned in here.
Yeah, it's a little warm outside.
It is.
You know, what do the wildlife really have problems with, you know, we've got... You know, certainly we're outside in the heat and humidity. It certainly bothers us. What about our wildlife?
Well, Jamie? It's probably a blessing we've had so much rain, so access to water hasn't really been an issue for them. But I suspect they lay low just like we do, and kind of loss of appetite. I certainly haven't had as much of an appetite the last couple of days. But, yeah, I mean, we're still seeing animals out. I've seen more deer and fawns out during the daytime, which they may be having some impacts with the black flies and the mosquitoes in the woods right now. But, yeah, they're still out moving around, eating.
And certainly, you know, animals prepare for this warm weather. In the spring, they molt and they shed their coat, just like your dog would, for example. And so, you know, some of their physiology actually equips them to be prepared for this hot weather. And they survive it. They stay in the shade like we do and drink plenty of water and just kind of lay low.
Well, I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. If you have a question or comment, I hope you'll reach us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a photo, question, or a comment right there. And some callers already. Mike had two hummingbirds that were coming to his feeders regularly, and then they suddenly stopped. Do hummers come to feeders less when there are a lot of flowers blooming, or might there be another explanation? David?
Well, that is a good question, and I think listening, certainly when Scott's on the radio, and since we've been on the radio, there are a lot of questions. It's a common question about, I've seen this animal, and I don't see any more. What's happening? Is the population decreasing, or what? Certainly when, you know, we're in the growing season and all the flowers are in full bloom right now, and there is plenty of food naturally available to the wet hummingbirds. And so they're tending to nests and, probably on their second clutch of eggs right now. And they don't like to go too far from that nest. So perhaps if the hummingbird feeder is a little bit further from the nest and they're comfortable, they may stay with the natural food. And they also may sometimes be around. They may change their activity patterns a little bit, and so they still may be coming to the hummingbird feeder, but we may not be watching the hummingbird feeder while they're there.
Yeah.
And so there's a number of explanations that could kind of help understand that.
Bunch of possibilities there. We had a Facebook question from Dave in Augusta. He says, I've been having a bear show up in my farmyard, showed up three times in the past 2 weeks, other than doing the obvious, like keeping the trash sealed and put away. Anything else I can do to discourage that big guy from making this a habit? I love watching them, although my wife is nervous about them being around.
Well, to answer Dave's question, and this isn't, we've had quite a few this spring concerns about bears in backyards, and a lot of it has pertained to them coming into bird feeders. And we had a very late spring, and when those bears woke up from hibernation, there were not a lot of natural foods available for them. So they were seeking out other types of food associated with humans, and people were seeing them more regularly in backyards. And so the best thing, and he's, you know, already done some of that, but keep your garbage sealed up, take down any bird feeders or suet feeders, and just, you know, put them away for the time being. He mentions he lives on a farm. So any type of food source that's being provided to the domestic animals should be try to contain it, minimize it.
Yep.
He's most likely wandering around looking for food. So try to make it really difficult. Don't feed any pets outside or leave dog food in dishes outside in the yard. You know, clean it up when they're done eating. And then the other thing, when he does see it from a safe distance, you know, yell, scream, shoo it away as soon as you see it, so that it doesn't get habituated to being around people. If he continues to visit, then I'd contact your local DNR office and just let them know about it and keep tabs on it through them.
Mm-hmm. I did see a black bear attack on someone not that long ago.
Yeah, there's been two in the state this year in backyards on people, which is really rare.
As far
as black bears go, in North America, there's only been 19 deaths to humans. It's very rare for them to cause death, but we have had two incidents where people were injured from a black bear. So again, following some of these procedures is a good idea.
But I think one of the problems that we have a lot of conflicts with bears and humans when those bears become habituated or lose their fear of humans. So what Jamie said about trying to scare that bear out of the area and put the fear of humans into that bear will reduce the conflict for sure. And the other thing, Dave, I'll add quickly is because you are on farmland, and as Jamie correctly identified, you know, contact your DNR biologist or the area supervisor. But Wisconsin has got one of the premier wildlife damage abatement claims programs in the country, and bear are one of the four species where you're eligible as a farmer if you are having crop damage, that you can get both abatement techniques, so some scare devices and some help trying to non-lethally control the bear damage. And then if that doesn't work, you can also get financially compensated for your crop damage. So make sure to contact your DNR biologist.
Very good point. Burl in Cassville, turn to you now. Hi, Burl. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. About 3 summers ago, I came across a pair of otters frolicking in the backwaters of Mississippi, perhaps about 10 miles downriver from Cassville. And I have not seen them since. And I was wondering if that was a rare sighting or if there's a population of otters in Mississippi.
Jamie?
Well, thanks, Bert. Otters are pretty well distributed throughout the state. A lot of people believe they're kind of a northern species. In fact, we have quite a few otters, and they're doing well in southern Wisconsin as well, even in Dane County. So they certainly are a part of the Mississippi River ecosystem. But they are like anything, you know, you got to be in the right place at the right time to see them. So you were fortunate to be able to see them, that pair, and keep your eyes out. I've seen a few. My parents live on a river, and we see them occasionally, but certainly not on an annual basis.
Yeah.
Well, wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. They're very, very shy creatures, and I do feel fortunate to have had a chance to see them. If I may ask about beavers, what about the beaver population up and down the Mississippi?
Yeah, the beaver population is also very healthy in the state. In fact, they're the State Department of Natural Resources is going through a beaver management plan. There's a lot of different stakeholders involved in those decisions between trappers and landowners who are having nuisance problems, and even trout streams. They do block trout streams and can change the integrity of the stream itself and the fish that inhabit it. So they've been going through a management assessment on the beaver population, and you could find reports on both otters and beaver if you went to the Department of Natural Resources website and just typed in those names in their search menu, and you can look at some of the population. Basically, a lot of that is maintained or gathered from track surveys that they do in the winter, aerial surveys to look for tracks of the otter, and some beaver surveys as well, and then they look at what the trapper harvests are for the furs.
There we go. Thank you very much for calling, Burl. Russ in Janesville. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry. I get to travel all over Wisconsin, southern Minnesota, and Illinois, and I'm seeing a lot of dead crows this year, and I'm wondering if that's related to the West Nile.
Russ, when you say a lot of dead crows, are you talking dozens or hundreds or singles?
Probably in the last few weeks here, I've seen probably a couple hundred crows, and it's not just one here or there. I'll see three or four in a mile stretch or so.
Okay. Yeah, you know, I'm not aware of West Nile status right now in Wisconsin or the upper Midwest, but certainly crows are one of the susceptible bird species to West Nile virus, as are some of the blue jays and other birds like that. So it possibly could be, and, you know, if you're interested in pursuing that, the best thing to do probably is to call the State Department of Natural Resources in that particular state you're in, whichever state you're traveling through, and maybe report those crows, and also ask them what the status of the West Nile virus is for this year. But typically, if you know, we'll get calls, and we'll have one or two dead animals periodically over a month's time. We really don't worry about that. It's probably natural mortality. But when you start seeing multiples like you've reported here in a short period of time, then you start thinking more about disease avenues and some other non-natural causes of mortality. So perhaps it is something like West Nile.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Russ. Thanks for calling. Mike in Castle Rock. Oops, it is your turn. Hi.
Good morning. I have an ongoing prairie restoration project here in Castle Rock. I have approximately 200 milkweed plants that are in bloom, and the odor is so strong it almost gives you a headache. Blazing stars are right about to bloom, and no monarch butterflies. When I first moved in here, my God, they were hanging all over the plants. Now, it can't be that it's too hot or it's too cold or the wind's in the wrong direction or it's too wet or too dry. I think something else is happening. What's going on?
Okay.
That's a good question, Mike, and perhaps maybe better asked of Phil Pelletieri when he's on next. But I will wager a guess, perhaps, that you know, one of the things that's going on in the state of Wisconsin, there's been a humongous emphasis on prairie restoration. And perhaps years and years ago when you first started that there was little milkweed available for those butterflies, and now there's a bunch of it because a lot of people are restoring prairies. So there's a possibility that there's increased habitat available. Last year, for example, we were seeing a lot of wildlife concentrated around where human beings were because we had a drought. And where the human beings were concentrating, there was a lot of watering of plants and things like that going on, and those animals were in desperate need of water. And butterflies certainly like, you know, water, especially shallow areas for breeding purposes and things like that. And this year we've got more of a normal and even maybe a wetter than normal summer going on. And again, maybe there's enough water spaced out across the landscape that the butterflies don't have to concentrate to the extent that they have been in maybe the last couple of years. So those would be a couple of guesses on my part. But again, maybe if you are listening next time Phil Pelletieri is on, call back in with that question.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's very interesting. Thanks, Mike. Thank you very much for calling. And Dennis in Marinette County, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. The last couple weekends up in Marinette County, we've been hearing right at daybreak the ravens just walking and crowing, making all sorts of noise. Do you know why they would be doing that this time of year?
Okay, Jamie, have ideas?
Sure. Thanks, Dennis. My best guess, especially with the early morning, ravens, crows, both of them will harass other birds. So like owls, you'll see ravens flying and they'll gather and they'll call, and pretty soon you'll find more ravens following and adding into the chase, and they'll harass owls and just try to drive them out of their territory. And that might be an owl that was returning from its hunting activities through the night, and they've located where it was perched and have just, you know, given it all it can handle. We also see small birds, blackbirds, chasing crows. So it's something that they do to drive even crows out of their area to keep them away from their nests so they don't depredate their eggs or their nestlings that they have. So it's just kind of a behavior that's fairly common to some of these birds that will flock together. So that would be my guess, that they're chasing or pursuing another bird near your cabin.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Dennis. Thank you very much for calling. We have open lines. You can join in, too. David Drake, Wildlife Specialist with UW Extension. Jamie Nack, Wildlife Outreach Specialist. Both are in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, our guest today. You can join in with your question or comment, or maybe you've got an experience to share. The number's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page, question or a photo, at the Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of wildlife here in Wisconsin, Larry Mueller here with my guests David Drake and Jamie Nack from the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Great to have them along. And we have a quiz coming up. We'll get to that in a little bit with a chance for you to win a prize. But I want to remind you that you can join in at 800-642-1234. Kathy in Denmark has joined in, so let's go to her. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I don't know if you remember, but last year I put on your Facebook page a picture of our two baby hummingbirds in their little nest.
Yes.
And this year, the mother built her nest on the same spot.
Ah, awesome.
Neat.
Wonderful.
And I do have one question, though. Since March, we discovered an owl nest, and I was taking pictures of the baby owl until it's a great horned owl. And because they're androgynous, we called the baby Pat.
From Saturday Night Live.
But yes.
Yes.
But we watched it until it fledged, and now it's still in the woods. And every night we hear it about every 30 seconds squawking. Is that to let the mama know where it is?
It could be. Also may be communicating with other owls out there and just seeing what else is out there. So they can be noisy birds for sure.
When do they start hunting for themselves?
Well, great horned owls are typically one of the first nesting birds in the state of Wisconsin. They can nest as early as end of January, early February, something like that, because they're cavity nesters. And so they've got a protected nest in that cavity. And I'm guessing the size of those owls, it probably takes, I don't know all this offhand, but I'm thinking it probably takes close to a month for those young owls to fledge to the point where they've got enough feathering that they can actually leave the nest and fly on their own.
So, we have pictures of it.
Yep. So it would, they're going to, and then as they are out with the mom, she's going to start teaching them how to hunt, and they're going to start hunting on their own a little bit after that. So it probably would be pretty quickly after they fledge that they would start at least experimenting with trying to hunt.
Oh, okay. Because it's really squawking, mom, feed me, mom, feed me.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Yep. And that could be that, the mom still is probably bringing some food to them possibly if they need some help.
Yep.
She only had the one. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. And that's true for raptors a lot, that they have asynchronous hatching, and so for most raptors they will not lay all the eggs, and the eggs won't hatch out all within a day or so, but they might hatch out within a week, and so you'll get the first hatchling can be rather large, and especially in open hawk nests, you'll get a lot of siblicide where the firstborn or first hatch will actually kick the younger siblings out of the nest to reduce the competition.
Yeah, absolutely. Kathy, thank you. Not a pleasant thought.
It's a hawk world out there.
I had a bird expert on once talking about the amount of depredation that goes on from brother to sister or brother to brother or sister to sister. We have Craig in Lake Mills with a question. Craig, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you for having me on air.
Sure.
I was calling about the individual that commented about many dead crows. Would it be important to collect a crow and possibly contact, not only the DNR, but the university? I think they have one of the top labs for, if I pronounce this correctly, necropsy. I'm not positive.
Necropsy, yeah.
Yep. Necropsy is the animal version of human autopsy. And so,
correct.
Yeah, so you could... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Craig.
The reason for this could be possibly someone poisoning carrion in an attempt to kill local predators, and these crows have found that carrion, dined on this carrion, for that number of dead crows in a general vicinity. Just my thought on it. I'm not positive about this. It's just a thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, anything's possible, and that's, again, when you start seeing multiple numbers of dead animals of the same species within a relatively short time period. Then we start getting a little suspicious about what might be killing those, and is it a non-natural cause of mortality? So the best thing to do is to, again, perhaps call your DNR biologist in your county, or if you've got a service center in your area, call there. And we do have a very good vet lab here on campus, but more importantly, we've got probably one of the premier wildlife veterinary health centers in the world here in South Madison, and that's part of the United States Geological Survey. And I would recommend that maybe rather than you picking up the dead birds, you let somebody with some disease background do it, because a lot of times when they come out, before they pick up anything at all, any of the carcasses, they actually look around at the site to see if there's anything environmentally going on before they actually touch the carcass. And then they pick up the carcasses in a very specific way so that they don't contaminate the carcass and things of that nature. So maybe contact it. If there are a lot of dead crows around and you're curious about that or concerned, perhaps contact the DNR when you get off the phone with Larry.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. David Drake and Jamie Knack are guests today. Just to mention, coming up at 2 o'clock today, I wanted to mention Kathleen Dunn and her guests discuss Working Mothers Magazine's annual report of the best companies for hourly employees. That's today at 2 o'clock. Right now we're talking about the world of wildlife with David and Jamie. Thank you for listening in. Really appreciate it. We have Joe and Osseo next with a question. Hi, Joe. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me on the air. My question is, I raise pastured poultry in Osseo, and I have to deal with predators.
Sure.
My preference would be to not destroy them. I've tried relocating a possum, and I believe it worked. Could you tell me, through the range of predators, which would be effective for relocating?
Well, Joe,
listen.
All right, thanks for
Joe,
calling.
That's a great question. And David and I just got back from the Farm Technology Day show that was up in the Rice Lake area. And at least for me, when I was working, that was a very common question dealing with predators. Backyard, even chicken coops have been really popular. And one person may be dealing with a badger, the next a great horned owl, the next a raccoon and a mink or a short-tailed weasel. So the one thing is that these animals are a huge draw. They're attractants for a lot of wildlife. So you're going to continue to deal with that without knowing exactly what the husbandry practices are that you have. We encourage people to build some really solid fences that are actually trenched into the ground and have a little bit of a flange on them so that animals can't dig their way into the fence. Obviously, if you can keep the animals contained where they're not free ranging, that's going to solve a lot of your problems. But in answer to your question on what animals can be relocated, first of all, the rules state that you may not relocate an animal unless you have permission from the property manager in the case of public land. That would include county parks and state parks and so on, or the permission from a private landowner. So if you know somebody who is willing to have an animal relocated on their property, like a possum, and they give you permission, that is certainly acceptable. Otherwise, it's a bit more difficult to just driving down to the state DNR property and releasing an animal. You technically cannot do that. So those are the laws. Now, there are other options. You can, lethally trap the animal. You can dispatch the animal humanely. And sometimes those perhaps are solutions that you might want to give a second thought to. Actually, if you think about humaneness, perhaps just releasing an animal somewhere else isn't all that humane either, because you're throwing them into a new territory. They have to defend themselves. If it's a species that is territorial, they're subject to being run out or killed by a different animal as well. And they certainly got to find cover and food in short order, or they're going to succumb to the circumstances. So there are other options. I think one of the best things is being proactive on how you house those animals and trying to keep animals away altogether and perhaps doing some trapping yourself on the property.
And thanks again for that question. David and Jamie like to throw a quiz question out to all of you, so we've got another one today. We'll pick a winner at random from all the correct answers, and that person will receive, what will they receive?
Oh, we've got three bird-related publications today, all through Cooperative Extension, and we're authors on a few of them, so it's a little biased, but
self-promotion never hurts.
Self-promotion. Birding in the Badger State and Beyond, How to Get Started. There's one on bird feeding, tips for beginners and veterans, and another one on shelves, houses, and feeders for birds and mammals. So,
set of three.
And I think during one of your fun drives, you actually had to contribute money to get that set. Here, it's easier. You just have to answer a question.
Well, you can email your answer. I'm going to tell you how to do this first. You email your answer to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And then in the subject line, put the word quiz. So put the word quiz in the subject line. And then you also need to include your first and last name and where you live in the message so that we can mail this to you. You can also call 1-800-642-1234 with your answer. But you may run into some busy phone lines. That's always an issue. So it might be easier just to email your answer. We'll give you 10 minutes to get your answer in. And here is the question. This is when you have to listen. You're going to listen to a bird song. What bird does this song belong to? And let's give a listen. Okay, I'm going to do it once more. Let's listen once more.
Sounds fair.
All right, there you have it. I'll tell you what, we're going to give you 10 minutes to get your answers in. So what bird does that song belong to? So call or email with your answer. And then we have ways to do this, like it's sort of like drawing the name out of a hat, but we can do it electronically. Judith knows how to do it. She's good at it. And we'll announce the winner in about 10 or 12 minutes. So, and I would just say, just in the way of a hint, it's not one that you hear every day.
No, it is a very rare bird, and we'll talk more about it after the answer is revealed.
Larry in Waupaca, it's your turn. Hi, Larry. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. I have a couple of questions. One is a bear question. The other one is a sandhill crane question. Which one do you want, or which one do you want first?
Let's go with a bear.
Well, we had a lovely, huge black bear in the neighborhood a while back, and unfortunately, a neighbor had honeybees, and they didn't get along, and so the bear was done away with. So I feel bad about that. I wonder if there's anybody defending the bears in cases like that. It seems to me they should have some privileges, too. I remember the Republican governor of New Jersey several years ago canceled the bear hunt. She said, we've got 6,000 bears and 6 million people, something like that. We don't need to kill the bears. What's happening with bears?
All right.
Well, Larry, in Wisconsin, our bear estimate, there's a pretty good range right now. We're going through a study to try to narrow that range and get a good estimate to the population. But, you know, roughly 25,000, 30,000 bears in the state. Annually, about 5,500 are harvested through a bear hunting season. And I guess to get into your question on that local bear or that specific issue, it's kind of hard for us to analyze that, not knowing the entire, you know, story in the background. But I can tell you typically when bears come in contact with humans and are habituated, there are a few options that USDA Wildlife Services takes, and they are contracted through the Department of Natural Resources. So between those two offices, they make some of those decisions. When it's a concern for human health and safety, they may go in and use a large culvert trap where the animal is caught alive, and then it is relocated a set distance far enough away where they hope that it won't return. It's kind of a three strikes program, and it depends on the severity of the infraction as to how many times they may attempt to relocate a given bear. But I know of cases in campgrounds where bears continue to come back even after being relocated. Eventually, that animal is euthanized. And again, human health and safety. In the case of the beehive, there is a pretty good defense to keep bears. It's very common for them to come in and get into private beehives. And one of the things that people can do is run an electric fence around the colony of hives, or the setup of hives. And that can be very effective thing to dissuade the bears from coming in there. Not again, I can't really relate to what's going, you know, what
that
happened in that specific
one, yeah,
situation, but there are things that, you know, it's not the goal to go and kill every single bear as soon as it does something wrong. It's a matter of once they become habituated, they really don't have a lot of options, and they have to be careful about human health and safety.
Well, Jamie, Ontario has a around Chapelot, they have something like 1 million acres, a huge preserve where there are lots of black bears, and I wonder if we have anything like that or contemplating a preserve. I'd love to have you set aside 1 million acres.
Yeah. we just don't have the same landscape in Wisconsin. I mean, we're fairly populated, and while we have some large national forests, those too have many users of that national forest, from hikers and cross-country skis and our skiing and ATV trails and snowmobiling. So it's really a balance of how many bears is both biologically and socially acceptable in our area and our state.
And you had a question about sandhill cranes?
Yes. I wonder, I see pairs around now, whereas earlier they would be three or four together. A lot of sandhill cranes here. But I worry when I see three and then a month later it's just a young couple. Have they lost their colt, or do they hang around? Do they leave home fairly soon? I don't know.
David?
Larry, that's a good question. They it can be a combination of factors. So obviously, you know, young animals, new hatchling birds and newborn mammals and things like that are very vulnerable to predation. And so it is possible that some of those colts were predated. It's unlikely that they have left the parents yet. They are stay with them for a little while and will certainly migrate together in mass flocks later this fall. So it's most likely the fact that it probably got predated.
Yeah, yeah, that's probably it. Thank you, Larry, for calling. Appreciate your call. Steve in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have two questions. We were just up in Mercer last week, and we heard a bird song that we could not identify, and we couldn't find the bird no matter how hard we looked. You could hear it any time during the day, but it was prolific in the morning and at night, and it's very flute-like, long, melodious, unlike any other song. Flute-like and melodious is the only way I could use to describe it, and it was just a gorgeous song, but we couldn't figure out what the bird was. And the other question is, there's a 12 to 14 pound terrier at risk from owls at night.
Yeah, okay.
Well, let's start with the dog one first. Typically not, but you may want to weight that dog down with a heavy anchor or something like that just in case, Steve. Most of the time, your dogs will be fine, especially if you are near the dog and or the dog is near a human dwelling and things like that. But it's not uncommon. I shouldn't say it's not a terribly common thing, but I'll relate a story that happened in Battery Park in the south side of Manhattan in New York City. They use peregrine falcons and red-tailed hawks and things like that to rid parks of rats and pigeons and stuff of that nature. And a number of years ago, a woman's hairless chihuahua got picked up by one of the red-tailed hawks that was being flown through the park and was returned safely to the woman with a few puncture wounds in its skin, but it lived. And so it is sometimes on very infrequent things like that can happen, but I'm guessing that your dog, for the most part, at 14 pounds, will be pretty safe.
Yeah, absolutely. And the bird's call.
The bird call, if you want to go, Steve, if you have a computer, go to ebird.com. So E as in echo, BIRD.com, ebird.com. It's the Cornell University Lab of Ornithology site. And I would ask you to look up, it's most likely a hermit thrush. And thrushes are beautiful birds. Hermit thrushes kind of have a reddish-brown back, head, and tail to them. And then on the belly is white with spots. They are very, very common in, up in the area of the state that you were talking about. Very loud. Again, very. I think you described their call perfectly, melodious and flute-like. And so if you go to ebird.com and type in hermit thrush, if you go down the page for hermit thrush, you'll see a tab for sound. And then you can click on a call, and then you can hear it there. So if it's not a hermit thrush, the other animal that I would maybe ask you to type in is veery, V-E-E-R-Y. And a veery also is similar to a hermit thrush. It's a thrush-type bird. It has also a flute-like call, but I kind of equate it to flute-like on steroids. So it's almost a very synthesized flute call. And if that is not it, the last one I would ask you to type in is wood thrush. But I'm guessing it probably is a hermit thrush. And again, as you mentioned, these birds kind of hang out in wooded areas. They're hard to see, especially with all the foliage on the trees and shrubs. But they have an absolutely gorgeous call.
Yeah, that's a great...
Our guess was one of the two thrushes. And we've seen those thrushes there in the woods, usually close to the ground. These calls are coming from the tops of the trees.
Yeah.
And we've seen the thrushes typically close to the ground. But we thought maybe one of those two thrushes would be the owner of that voice. Spectacular song.
I'd go back to ebird.com. I had thought, when you talked about it, I thought veery right away. But I think David might be... go back to ebird.
Yeah, go to ebird. Try hermit thrush first, because they're also extremely common up in that part of the state. And you hear them all the time, but you also will hear wood thrush on occasion and veery as well.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And speaking of bird songs, we have a winner from our contest, and I'm going to play the song again. So listen to the song. Here it is. And And the answer is Kirtland's warbler.
Yep, exactly right. So that was one of the warbler species that comes back to our state to nest, and then they leave our state in the fall to go back down to the southern part of the United States into Central America to winter down there. And the Kirtland's warblers, warbler songs can be very difficult to identify. A lot of them can sound alike, and again, they're very warbler-like, and that's the name, one of the reasons for the name of the bird. But the Kirtland's warbler is one of the more endangered, federally endangered bird species in North America, partly because of habitat loss. They are tightly associated with young jack pine stands, and also partly because their nests seem to be especially parasitized by brown-headed cowbirds.
Oh.
But there's a wonderful recovery story going on in Wisconsin. And about, 5 or 6 years ago, a Kirtland's warbler all of a sudden showed up in Adams County in the central part of Wisconsin, where we've got jack pine up there. And ever since then, they've been closely monitored by the DNR and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And last year, I think they said they had 24 singing males, or at least 24 singing males, and 10 females, and they've had some fledglings. Nests and successful fledglings, and this year they had the very first fledgling return to where it was born. So they captured
news.
A fledgling last year, banded it, and then it came back as a adult this year. So they're starting to spread their range a little bit more, and they're starting to increase in numbers. So they are no longer concentrated just to the lower peninsula of Michigan, but now they're found in Ontario, upper peninsula of Michigan, and in different parts of Wisconsin. So there's a great story going on, and we hope that it continues in a positive trend.
And let's listen just once more. There you have it. And the contest is over, of course. And the winner of our three booklets is Catherine M. No, I'm not going to give the last name. So it's Catherine, first initial M, in Lac de Flambeau. So, Catherine, you are the winner. I think, I'm not sure how many people had the correct answer, but you were one of them, and you won the drawing. So you're gonna get those books.
Congratulations.
Yep.
Good job.
Well done.
Our guests today, David Drake, wildlife specialist, and Jamie Knack, wildlife outreach specialist, both with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. David, also UW Extension specialist. I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in today as we talk about the world of wildlife here with Jamie Knack and David Drake of the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension. Great to have them along. Thank you for listening. I actually have an open line or two you can get on at 1-800-642-1234. If you have a photo or a question, you can also post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show or email us at talk@wpr.org. Daniel in Minong has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dan.
Hello. When I was young, I traveled all over these north woods as a helper on a beer truck. The roads were unpaved sand. Occasionally, a black rope would stretch across the road. I could never get the drivers to stop so the snakes would be run over. I was told they were pine snakes. How many years would it take for a pine snake to reach 8 or more feet long in the north woods?
Thanks for the question, Daniel. Unfortunately, that does happen. You know, same with turtles. Some people, unfortunately, intentionally run them over or just don't take the time to avoid them. So hopefully we can change some of that. But to answer your question, the pine snake, which is a common name for the western fox snake, so those two are interchangeable and lots of people refer to them as the pine snake, is a very pretty chocolate brown, almost reddish brown color for the base, and then it has black blotches or squares running down the dorsal side of that animal. I'm referring to the Snakes of Wisconsin book, which is a field guide for our snakes, specifically in our state. And there it lists the length for an adult from anywhere to from 3 feet to 5 feet. So, you know, perhaps just memory serves and thinks that, you know, mm-hmm. recall it being a lot larger than that. But as far as how long to get to that, their adult length or that larger 5 feet, they're going to grow rather quickly in the first year or two. And after that, additional length is going to take, you know, quite a bit of time. David and I were hazarding a guess here that, you know, a long-lived snake, you know, probably looking at 8-10 years would be pretty long. They still have a number of predators to contend with, but 5 feet, 4 to 5 feet is a pretty good size pine snake.
There we go. Thank you for that question. And Dick in Bark River, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yes, I'll try to do this quickly. In the 80s and 90s, I was employed Michigan DNR in the parks just north of Menominee, Michigan. I, of course, had the authority to trapping skunks in the campground. I'm not exaggerating, 16 of them, live trap, in a blanket over the top and transport them 8 miles away. And at home, this is bragging, a mother raccoon and either 8 or 9 kits or cubs. I had a large metal trunk string trapdoor. Got them all.
Uh-huh.
And they have to be relocated, say, 20 miles away, because they do home from about 5, 6, 7 miles. But people must follow the laws and be careful about handling them. But I think that was a record. 9 raccoons at once.
In one that's fell swoop.
Well,
one
a lot of times
swoop.
If you...
Thank you.
Yeah, if you get mom, that helps.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Mom goes in first.
Right.
That's for sure. And Dick was absolutely correct. If you trap skunks, cover the trap, with live trap with a blanket, and if you can darken the trap, the skunk will calm down immensely, and you can easily move the skunk without getting sprayed.
Yep, there you go. And I was thinking back when he mentioned all those young raccoons. We were hiking in one of the state parks. Forget one, which one now, but a mom and I think 6 little ones came along, and we got some nice pictures. They were all with their hand kind of paws over a log that is laying down looking at us. It was pretty...
Yeah, they're neat animals until they get in your trash.
Peninsula State Park,
okay.
That's where we were.
Yep.
We were
up in
Peninsula.
Door County, sure.
Vicki in Lancaster. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, last February I had a Carolina wren show up at my backyard bird feeder, and I wasn't sure what it was, and it looked like a wren on steroids, and it was around for 2 weeks, and then it just disappeared. I've never seen it again. I was just wondering if this is normal. I didn't realize they were in Wisconsin.
David?
Yeah, yep. They are. We've got a number of wren species in Wisconsin: house wrens, Carolina wrens, winter wrens, marsh wrens, and they all are kind of characteristic of a relatively small brownish bird, and they've got some mottling on their body typically. They've got kind of a very thin, almost curved bill to them. And a lot of times for the size of them, they are very, very loud. So if you're near their nest, they'll chatter at you until you leave, and just kind of neat birds to see. And a lot of times they'll occupy, if you have a birdhouse out, they'll occupy that birdhouse. And they're, especially Carolina and house wrens, are very common to be around human dwellings.
Very
okay.
Cool.
So do they winter here, or did it just come back that early?
Let me think about that. That's a good question. I think that they winter here, but I will check on that at break, and if I'm wrong, we will correct my mistake.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And we have some, I should deal with some emails and so forth that we've also gotten. Lynn from Shawano says, great horned owls are not cavity nesters. Many owls are, but not a great horn. They nest in old hawk nests or squirrel caches or other nests that are already made. Is that pretty true?
Well, Lynn is partly correct. Lynn, I'm going to disagree with you, and I would ask if you guys want to just double-check me, validate my answer. You're welcome to look it up in a bird book or, again, on the Internet, because you know everything on the Internet is true. But that is absolutely true that great horned owls will nest in other nests. So they will occupy squirrel nests or what's called drays, and they'll occupy hawk nests and things like that. But they also will nest in cavities of big oak trees and things like that. They'll nest also if a tree gets, for example, a pine tree gets topped, and where that break is, that there might be some dead wood in the center. They'll nest in that topped tree and things like that. But they will nest in cavities.
An email from, by the way, you can join in. We have open lines to get you on at 1-800-642-1234. This email from Allison: I just moved to La Crosse. What Mississippi River birds can I try to attract to my yard, and with which flowers?
Well, Allison, that's a great question. I probably won't be able to be as specific as I would like to on your reply as far as species of flowers and so on. But in general, no matter where you are, providing more habitat is going to attract more species of birds. So when you think about planning your landscaping in the yard, first of all, plant native. They're going to be more accustomed to the soils and climate of your area, and the local birds will respond better as well. And then think about planting both fruit-bearing and all different types of food sources, so fruits and nuts and nectar plants and so on. But then look for plants that bear that food source at different times throughout the growing season, and even into the winter there will be species that will hold on to those berries. We do have an extension publication called Landscaping for Birds, and there are some other excellent sources of information on landscaping in the Midwest. Marriott Novak is one of the authors. And the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources has some wonderful Landscaping for Wildlife publications that will give you much more in terms of specific plants. But the goals here are diversity, different types of food, and then being able to provide it throughout the growing season. And then certainly water and coniferous plants, trees, conifers for winter thermal cover is also really important.
And I'll just add, we have roughly 400 bird species here in Wisconsin. So one thing you might want to do is get a bird book of eastern birds, for eastern region of North America, and you can go down the list of all the birds in that book, and usually most books have a range map associated with each species account, and then you can find kind of where you are in that range map and see which birds are in your area that you have the possibility of attracting to your yard.
Very good. I think we have... I don't know how many I have bird books I have at home. I think I've got seven or eight.
Same here. It's nice to compare between them.
It's fun. Yeah. They're all a little different.
Yep.
Jean in Elk Mound, hello. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, guys. Sure. I have a puzzle, and I'm my property surrounded by the waterfall, Red Cedar Waterfall production area. And I talked to them, but 2 years in a row, I've had a batch of bluebirds go missing.
Yeah.
And they think it's a snake. And last year, it was actually, they were just getting their feathers. And all six of them disappeared. There was no blood, no feathers, nothing. This year, it was all the eggs right before they hatched.
So Jean, a couple questions for you, I guess. Do you have a predator guard or one of the funnels that can be placed on the post? That prohibits.
I do not have one yet.
So
I have crow guards on the front end.
Yeah. Well, so for bluebirds, there's a few species. Raccoon is a possibility. Again, it kind of depends on the size opening. If you're following the guidelines of keeping that entrance hole.
But wouldn't it be more bloody, or you'd see traces?
No, not necessarily. I did some, my master's research was on grassland bird nests and their predators. We put little cameras on the nest and followed what predators came in. And, you know, the reason to do that is a lot of times the nest predator is inferred by just by looking at the scene after the depredation. And basically that study is showing that you can't infer from what remains. So raccoons are extremely dexterous with their hands. And whether they'll eat both eggs and chicks, and all you see is a completely intact nest bowl. They don't really even dishevel it very much or pull it apart when it's on the ground. Now, in a bluebird house, they may dishevel it or pull it apart a little bit because they're reaching through an opening. So I just throw out that a bluebird is a possibility. Unfortunately, there's lots of possibilities. And a snake is certainly one of them. Is a possibility as well. One thing you might try is what's called a baffle or a predator guard, and you can either buy them or you can make them out of tin, but it's a cone that fits around about halfway up on the guard, and animals have a difficult time manipulating them, getting around that baffle.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And you have to make sure the bluebird house is accurately put together. I know there was some jokes about people making great owl feeders.
They came from the waterfall people, so
yeah.
Okay,
they're built correctly. But, yeah. So yeah, taking
a question is or a comment for you for the lady that was talking about the wrens. Just give them a Dixie cup of mealyworms, and they'll be your best friend. That's what I do with the bluebirds too.
Yeah, give them little mealybugs, and oh yeah, they like that. They would like that all year.
They allow me to take pictures from eggs to hatch. Until they fledge.
Oh. That's...
But it costs a lot of mealyworms.
Great story, Jean. Thank you very much for calling and talking with us about your bluebirds. I'm sorry they're being predated, but I think you need to put in some extra safeguards and things could well improve.
Well, and if I can just interject one more thing, too, that she might try is if you do have a trail camera...
Oh, that'd be
you can
perfect.
Mount it onto that or near the bird feeder. Put a post in the ground and mount that trail camera pointed towards the bird feeder, and you'll get lots of pictures of bluebirds, but you might find out what's going on there, too.
David Drake and Jamie Knack from the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, our guests. They'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network. We are talking about the world of wildlife with our two guests from the UW, David Drake and Jamie Knack. Great to have them along. Certainly, if you have a question about wildlife here in the state, or maybe you've got an experience to share, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And if you've got some photos, we'd love to see them. And matter of fact, John Nelson posted some great shots here of a nest with...
Looks like at least three
baby birds, and I can't tell what they are.
Jamie and I were just looking at that picture as well, and it's difficult to tell. John, if you are listening, if you could call in, maybe we could talk to you a little bit about and get some clues. I also would like to just find out how you got that picture. It's a pretty interesting perspective.
Yeah, very interesting. Go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show if you can, and take a look at the photos that John's put up. They're pretty cool. There's also a photo of an albino squirrel.
Oh, cool.
That's another. A listener sent in as well.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, look at that.
Yeah, you can see the pink eye. It's definitely a
true albino. Yep. What a cool picture. Again, that's at my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We had... a question from Jackie from Milwaukee wondering if only birds are indicators of West Nile or can squirrels be affected. She and her neighbor live on a small creek and they have seen several dead squirrels, and also the population in general seems to have declined. Jamie, what do you think?
All right. So West Nile virus most commonly affects corvids, which are the blue jays and the crows and so on. So, but it can also, there's... a form that can infect horses, and it can infect humans, and not very commonly, but it can occur in wild animals as well, in other species of birds outside of the corvid family. So squirrels can be affected. That doesn't happen very often. My hunch or my guess would be that something else is going on, and whether that's just of natural causes or there is some sort of disease outbreak or perhaps just predation going on where you're finding these dead squirrels. It's really hard to say. Again, the best frame of reference, I think it's an important observation, important enough to go ahead and call the local Department of Natural Resources biologist or office and report it. And they have a pulse on what's going on in their counties and can maybe give you some more immediate local feedback. And if they're interested, they'll come out and collect one of those animals for a necropsy so they can analyze it and find out what's going on. So certainly do report it. And like I said, they can carry West Nile, but just it's not very often that you see it in squirrels.
And a Facebook question from Carolyn Trigo. I love to whistle, and I've tried to mimic some bird calls when I'm outside. Sometimes it seems like they're answering me. Am I crazy, or is this possible?
Well, Carol, I'm not a mental health expert, so I cannot comment on your mental state. But it is very possible the birds will respond. And again, if you were to take a playback device out and play a bird call, for example, and that species in the area, they may very well respond, especially during nesting season when they're defending territory and things like that. So depending on how well you are at mimicking the particular species you're trying to identify or trying to call, you very well could be getting a call back.
And let's turn to Bob in Wauwatosa. Hi,
good
Bob.
Morning.
Yeah, good afternoon.
We've got a big red oak in the backyard with a cavity in it that years ago was inhabited too frequently by raccoons. And since we have about a 32-pound dog that had a confrontation face-to-face with one of those raccoons and we got off easy, nothing happened, we had the raccoons flushed out, and we covered the hole with a double layer of quarter-inch hardware cloth. But unfortunately, that also is going to make that opening not accessible to owls. So my question is there some way to make it accessible to owls but not raccoons? And well, I'll take my answer off the air.
All right,
sure,
thanks,
Bob. You know, there are trade-offs with that. I mean, certainly if you leave the snag standing or the dead tree, it is going to be attractive to a number of different species of wildlife, probably the primary one being raccoons. So I would have suggested hardware cloth as well to try to keep the raccoons from getting in there. It's possible on top of that hardware cloth, maybe putting some plywood, more of a platform that might mimic the natural wood surroundings and might be more attractive to an owl. But after that, I mean, it's really up to the animals to find it and decide that it's appropriate and use that potential platform or space. So that's the only additional thing I can think of is maybe putting a piece of plywood over that metal hardware cloth.
And it looks like we have another, John had posted another photo that I hadn't seen first of a bird sitting on a nest. Could it be that same nest?
We were talking about this, and if you go to Larry's Facebook page, you'll see the nest. It's kind of suspended from a fork in a branch in a tree, and there are certain bird species that will suspend nests like that, orioles, but orioles have more of a woven nest, more of a bag-like pouch nest. Hummingbirds will also nest like that, but they're very small nests, and usually the nests are conspicuously built with lichens. This particular nest, one of the things we suggested maybe was vireo, and I guess, again, you just have to take our word for it that we're not lying to you out there. But John confirmed it is a red-eyed vireo, and that is a very common species of bird up in the northern woods of Wisconsin. And red-eyed vireos, again, if you've not seen one of those birds, maybe go to a bird book or look at it online. One of a number of species of vireos we have in the state, again, very common in wooded areas, and their song is Here I Am. Where are you? Here I am. Where are you? And just a really neat bird. And all vireos have a hooked upper bill similar to a shrike. So that's one way you can also identify them if you get a good enough look at the bill.
Well, and that's just it. They're hard to see. I mean, you hear them singing, you recognize their song. But actually being able to locate the bird, they're usually, you know, moving around high in the canopy. So to even have the nest and the bird, that's wonderful. Great work.
Yeah, great work, John. Thank you. We have Rick in Viroqua with a question. Hi, Rick. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you. Good afternoon to your guest as well. Thank you for me to have the opportunity to ask them. I got like four little creatures that look like ferrets, but they're a little smaller, and I don't know how to get rid of them.
They're in your wood shop?
Yeah, they're in my wood shop, yeah. It's a building on the edge of the woods, and I seen them the other day crawling up the wall. I didn't know they could do that.
Well, Rick, I'm guessing that you probably have one of the three weasel species that we have in our state in your wood shop. And most likely, we've got long-tailed weasel, short-tailed weasel, and least weasels. All of those three species will eat small mammals like chipmunks and things like that. Typically, they're called stoats also, or ermine. They will go all white in the winter, and then in the summer, which is obviously now, their pelage should be kind of a dark to light brown on the back with a white belly. And the long-tail and short-tail weasel, if I recall my identification correctly, should have a black tip to their tail. Regardless, if you want to look those species up, either in a mammal identification book or, again, on the internet, most likely why they're in your wood shop is because you've got small mammals like mice, chipmunks, 13-line ground squirrels, or something like that, and those weasels are after those smaller mammals because that's their food base. And so if you can try to keep your wood shop as closed up as possible so that small mammals can't get in there, that would be beneficial. Certainly in wood shops, there's a lot of hiding places because you've got wood and equipment and things like that all over the place. So that's a little bit difficult. The other thing you might want to do is to just keep some mouse and rat traps in your wood shop, bait it with peanut butter, and keep a trap line running for a little while until you don't catch any small mammals any longer. And once the food base disappears, most likely the weasels will disappear as well.
There you go, Rick. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Jeff and Cataract, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there. You know what? You just answered my question.
I wondered if that was going to happen.
Yes, a 2-for-1.
I thought it was a red squirrel at first until I got a look at it. And indeed, it had a white belly that was kind of fawn-colored like a red squirrel. And it had a black tip on its tail. And then you answered the second part of my question was about 10 years ago, I found a dead one in the middle of wintertime, right on New Year's Day it was.
Yep.
And it was pure white except for the black tip on its tail.
Yep, and that would indicate then it's either the short or long-tailed weasel.
Okay, is there any way to identify which is which other than the length of the tail?
Well, I would go out of just for pure commonness, probably the short-tailed weasel is the most common. Long-tail, a little bit rarer, and least is very small, about the size of a cigar in terms of body size.
Oh, all right. I was bigger than that.
So my best guess, if I were just hazard a guess out of numbers and likelihood, probably a short-tailed weasel, mm-hmm. which is also the one that's commonly referred to as the ermine. And you could just go ahead and look that up on the internet and look at some of those pictures.
But thank you so much.
Yeah,
some of those weasel species are relatively common. We just don't see them that often because they're small and low to the ground and relatively secretive. But they're a pretty common animal.
Paul and Nina next. Hi, Paul.
Hi there. I have a question about northern goshawks.
Okay.
We've been watching a family. They actually had 3 or 4 babies that we could see. They're up quite high. But what's happened in the last couple of days is the nest has just disappeared altogether. The goshawks are coming back to that area yet. They're still in that tree, but I don't see the nest anymore. Is that unusual?
So, Paul, has the nest actually disintegrated? I mean, it's fallen out of the tree?
It's just totally gone.
Did you have a windstorm or anything like that?
No.
Huh, interesting.
And there, you know... goshawks get pretty big, you know, pretty tall. So I don't know if it was the weight of the 3 babies, because now they are full grown. I mean, they're at least 20, maybe 22 inches.
Yeah.
Huh. Tall.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, most raptors will come back to the same nest because and those nests just continue to accumulate sticks and twigs and nesting material, and they get bigger and bigger each year. But, you know, perhaps this was a first year nest, or perhaps this was the first nesting attempt of these birds, and they just weren't as experienced at building a nest yet. And as you mentioned, the weight and also the capacity of those extra birds in that nest may have just been enough to destroy the nest.
Right. That's what it seems like.
Interesting observation.
Thanks, Paul.
Okay. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Colleen in Hollister. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon. I'm calling about the thing that you want to use when your dog gets sprayed by a skunk. The thing is Gojo, the mechanics hand cleaner.
Yeah.
It absorbs grease and oils. So if your dog gets into a skunk, you rub the Gojo on the dog where the skunk sprayed him, let it sit there for a while, be sure and rub it in real good, and then rinse it off with water and smell is gone.
I had not heard of that one, so good.
Been a few years since I've had any Gojo on my hands. I remember it well back in my days of doing a little mechanic work.
Well, Stephen Wright, the comedian, has that famous joke that he used spot remover on his dog, and now he can't find him. So,
so Gojo is an answer. Another answer.
Yeah, there's a concoction that you can mix that is, I believe it's hydrogen peroxide, baking soda, and Dawn dish soap. And you do want to get those ratios correct. So I would go online, and that's pretty commonly used. And you can mix it up and give the dog a bath in it. You just don't want to store that mixture because it will explode.
Yeah. Colleen, yeah.
with the Gojo, you don't have to mix anything up. Just take it out of the can.
Yeah.
It's ready to go.
And it's ready to go. Thanks, Colleen. Gojo. Man, it's a term I haven't heard that in a long time.
That's right.
And, you know, Colleen says it works. I guess it'll work. Deborah and Brown Deer, your turn. Hi, Deb.
Hi. Well, I want to ask a question about a mink, but I first want to mention, address that lady who called early in the show about the screech owl, and that makes that the noise like a cackling, and I thought maybe it's a northern hawk owl instead of a screech owl, because they are similar except for the tufts. But it says under voice, variety of calls, including whistled, trills, rattles, screams, and a ki-ki-ki-ki-ki-ki. So anyway, I just want to put that out there. But I took a picture a couple of years ago of what I think is a mink, and I took it like there's a little, like a new, like they developed a little park along the bike path extension of the Oakley Trail in Brown Deer, and there's, I sat there for like an hour, and I got a picture, like three pictures of this, I think it's a mink, and it's in the water, and it's hiding in these little rocks, like crevasses, and I'm wondering, do you think it's a mink, and how do I determine between a mink and something else?
All right, Deborah, I'll take that one. So the mink, was it chocolate brown on its belly as well with maybe just a little bit of a white throat patch?
Well, now someone stole my camera recently, so I haven't...
You haven't looked at the pictures, so...
And it looks like it blends in with the rocks perfectly, and it does have... the chest seems a little lighter.
Yeah, so a mink is going to be pretty much uniformly chocolate brown. I would hazard maybe 18 inches to 24 inches or so, a pretty lengthy tail on it, still smaller than a loaf of bread, but kind of in that ballpark, and it's going to have a white throat patch. And the weasels, the more common ones with their summer pelage, are going to be almost a reddish brown or a lighter brown, and a lighter colored underbelly or a belly, pretty much white. The mink only has like a white throat patch, but mink would be a very good possibility. They are around riprap, and they are an aquatic fur bearer. They're eating fish and so on. In fact, I was walking around the Memorial Union, the old pier, and had seen a mink loping along the shoreline, and just kind of stopped and watched it, and it allowed me to approach pretty quick, and pretty soon it dove in and swam away, and I lost sight of it in the shallow water, and I waited and waited, and all of a sudden it came back to that exact spot, had a sunfish in its mouth, and it proceeded to eat it right. I was only 2-3 feet away from it.
Oh,
so
cool.
It was a very cool experience. So they're very common along those riprap shorelines.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Deb.
I just may address your quick comment about the northern hawk owl. Northern hawk owls typically are not this far south in the range, so it probably is not that. We do have screech owls here, and screech owls make a variety of noises, from screeching to whinnying like a horse and some other noises as well, but it's most likely not the northern hawk owl.
We have some more cool photos, but first, from Pete on Facebook, said, I was listening in the car, thought you might want to know that my wife saw a large bull moose while walking the dog early one morning a few weeks ago. We live in a remote area along the UP border, north of Boulder Junction. Are moose spotted frequently in Wisconsin?
Yeah, actually more frequently than you might think. But in terms of a population or, a large population, certainly not. But it's not uncommon for people to have a few moose reportings throughout the year. Again, when I was just at the farm show in Rice Lake, I had a couple people come up and share some stories of a bull moose that was in their area, and they had gotten pictures of it and shared the pictures and so on. So, yeah, they do come in, and there's actually been cows with calves sighted in the state as well.
And more photos. Tom sent us photos of chickadees in an old nest box with half the roof missing from Verona. And what do we got here? We got some turkeys, I think.
Yep. Looks like it under the feet are eating.
Yep. So that's on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. An email from Amy in Madison. I grew up in a house surrounded by woods, and we had lots of snakes, what we call grass snakes and garter snakes. But living here in Madison, I never see a snake. We have a wooded yard, and our neighbors do as well. So why no snakes?
Well, snakes don't do terribly well around human beings simply because we carve up their habitats so much. And if you just think about Madison and all the road systems and sidewalks and different types of habitat that snakes have to encounter and get across, that's not a terribly friendly habitat for them. So that's one of the reasons. And then the other issue is snakes are not a favored species of wildlife in general. And a lot of people, unfortunately, fear snakes. And when they see them, the old adage is the only good snake's a dead snake. And so people also kill them with some regularity. So snakes are, and the other issue is they're cold-blooded animals. And so they are active as the environment and atmosphere allows them to be active. And so they're just not terribly as common as, for example, a bird species or some of the more common mammal species and things like that.
We have Philip in Iola. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, I observed a loon on the Wolf River this spring when I was paddling. And of course, I heard all about the ice on the lakes. And I assumed this one, first loon I ever saw on the river, I assume it was there because of, the ice on the river. On the lakes, and also I'm just wondering how they survived, if there's any feedback on the numbers on the lakes.
Philip, I guess I would agree with your assumption as to why the loons were on the river. When they come up in this area and they need to find open water both to for habitat, because they feel most comfortable in the water, and they're a heavy-bodied bird, so they don't move very well on land, and they're easy prey for something to eat them. But they also obviously are fish-eating birds, and so they need access to that water to be able to dive and eat fish, and so they are looking for open water when ice is on other parts of the waters. So that's probably it. I'm not aware of issues harming loons, and I know my folks live up in central Minnesota. We were just up there for the 4th of July, and they live on a lake up there, and there's loons everywhere. So, typically they will go further north than at least southern Minnesota here, and we see them a lot of times in the fall when they come back as they're staging to migrate south and they're starting to raft up. But as far as I'm aware, the loons are doing pretty well. I know there's a lot of emphasis right now on trying to get lead out of the water so that loons are not eating lead as they eat the fish and other things like that. And so I think there's a lot of awareness about loons and people are knowledgeable about them, and I think that they're doing okay.
Thanks, Philip, for calling. Very quickly, would a woodchuck eat a baby bunny? It was on a bike trail and saw a woodchuck cross the trail with a small furry object in its mouth.
Well, two possibilities here. One, it is possible that it would eat a baby bunny. They typically are an herbivore, so are deer, and we've had deer eating nestlings, birds. So animals are typically classified by the majority of their diet. So even a fox that's a carnivore will eat other types of plant material or berries. So it's possible it was a baby bunny. Another possibility is that it was a baby woodchuck, and the mother was carrying it or relocating it.
There you go. Boy, we had lots of great questions. David, Jamie, thank you both so much. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Sounds good. We're looking forward to it.
David Drake, wildlife specialist with UW Extension, and Jamie Knack, wildlife outreach specialist, both with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Tomorrow we'll talk about protecting your skin, and also Rick Seney of faircompare.com talks about airfares. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.